at the edges, there's new conversation happening. There isn't a sector that isn't exploring in some way what more is needed and what more is possible. A more life-aligned worldview is emerging and rising and has so much to offer.
We tend to assume that we need to give things up if we're going to solve the environmental problems that we face. But what if this way of thinking is all wrong? This is the Second Transition Podcast. I'm Phil Loring. It's a well-worn refrain that we take too much, use too much, that we need to give things up and start living back within the limits of Earth. And while much of that is true, many people assume that this means we need to pursue austerity, lives of asceticism, that we need to give up the good life and make accommodations and sacrifices if we want to live sustainably. As today's guests will tell you, this way of thinking is all wrong. Michelle Holliday is an author and consultant whose acclaimed book, The Age of Thrivability, challenges us to align our lives with the living community and makes the case that if we do so, our lives will get better, not worse. Let's dig in. Today, I'm joined by Michelle Holliday, a consultant, facilitator, author, and researcher whose work centers around the notion of thrivability. This is based on a view of organizations and communities as dynamic, self-organizing, living systems. She's the author of the book, The Age of Thrivability, Vital Perspectives and Practices for a Better World. Michelle, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Your work starts with a focus on the things that we can learn from natural systems, lessons or principles, perhaps, that you argue can enable us to completely reimagine how we live, succeed, and thrive on this planet. Can you get us started with a short introduction to this notion of thrivability?
Sure. Thanks for asking. So at a basic level, it is what it sounds like. It is tending to life's ability to thrive, your life, the life of your organization or your project, of the community that you are embedded in and that you serve, and the biosphere. And more than that, I describe it as the informed intention and practice of tending to life's ability to thrive at all of those levels, of creating the fertile conditions for life to thrive in all of those ways. So informed, because if we're going to create the fertile conditions for life to thrive, we need to know something about what does that mean? What does it require of us? What does it involve? And there are many ways to get informed. I turn to biology and life sciences, but we can take inspiration from many different realms of life. Intention, because it's not currently our intention to enable life to thrive in most of our activities. We set our sights on something far less than enabling life to thrive, things that are reasonable, like productivity and profitability. But if we don't make it our clear and explicit intention for life to be able to thrive, then we'll continue to fall catastrophically short of that goal. So informed intention and then practice. It's not a marketing campaign. It's not just a project for a short time, or the job of the thrivability senior VP, you know, in an organization, but it's a life practice of deepening in wisdom and compassion, and the ability to sense what's needed and to respond with effective action.
Listening to you, I'm thinking here that you mentioned sort of contrasted thinking about thrivability to thinking about just, say, productivity. Mm-hmm. And we have these habits of thinking, right? They're very industrial. They're, mm-hmm. you know, if you want to solve the problem, break it down into parts, like it's a machine, figure out where the limit is in the machine to your productivity, and so forth. And then when we want to build new things, we want them to be scalable, replicable, like when we grow our food. But you know, you said you turned to biology, and living systems, biological systems don't work like that. They're not factories, right? And so I'm always interested in how we help people break out of these problematic habits or ways of thinking, because it's hard, right? Mm-hmm. And how do you help nudge people to think differently, to break mm-hmm. these habits?
I'm really grateful that you brought up that contrast between the two dominant worldviews that are sort of fighting for dominance right now. We are moving away from a mechanistic, extractive worldview of domination and control that has brought us many good things and also, I believe, is at the root of every major problem we face in the world. So it's really important to recognize the limits of that mechanistic, reductionist, extractive, colonizing, those challenges of that worldview, and also recognize the signs that another worldview is emerging. There's more to the story in which we are not machines, we are alive. Our bodies have mechanistic characteristics and properties, but that's not all that there is to us. Same in agriculture, same in every aspect of our lives. And this is a big focus of my book, to point to all of these signs that a more life-aligned worldview is emerging and rising and has so much to offer. So the second part of your question was how do we make that transition from a mechanistic worldview that's so all-pervasive we don't even realize it's just a story and that there are other stories available. I don't know if it's just me choosing my battles, but I generally feel that I can't convince someone who isn't ready. I haven't personally had a lot of success at that, but I can offer invitations, and people who are open find that invitation and are drawn to it. And I do have success there. So I think more and more of us are ready and open. And in the past 5 years, and in particular, the past almost 3 years of the pandemic, there's been an explosion of openness and readiness. So the limits of the mechanistic worldview are pushing more of us to see that there's got to be something more and to start to recognize the signs.
Michelle, you're reminding me here of a conversation I had a couple of episodes ago with a friend, Dr. Brett Favaro, and we were talking on that episode about climate change and electrification and renewable energy. But a similar point came up that there's one group of people who's already engaged, already activated. And then, of course, there's another group that is very opposed, absolutely not interested or ready to see things differently. But then that group in the middle of people who are interested, maybe need you to reach a hand out to them, need some help of bridging to a new worldview, a new way of thinking, but do sense that there is a different way of seeing the world available to them. How do you build that bridge?
So I start with an invitation and who's ready. I also wrote my book, and I generally try to speak as much in the language of the mechanistic worldview as I can. So the language of science is quite recognizable within a mechanistic story, and offer it as a bridge. I offer case studies. Look, it works. This is enticing. Don't you want to go there? Wouldn't that be better? And most of all, I'm part of a global community practice called The Art of Hosting, and it's about hosting conversations, but it's also philosophical. So there are methods of hosting generative, creative conversations, but there's a philosophy underlying it that what we're really hosting is what's alive in this group, you know? And so it's very aligned with my thinking. And I find that alone, it's very difficult to make a transition from one worldview to the next, but in conversation, it becomes easier. We kind of need to think out loud together and to check, do you see it too? Do you feel excited about that? And the final thing I'll share is being in nature. So having these conversations with some experience of being outside or being exposed to beauty helps connect us to our hearts, because I think in our hearts, we know this story. It lives in us. It's available to us at an intuitive level. So we need just enough to convince our heads to listen to our hearts in a way, you know? And so some combination of all of that I find to be effective.
That really resonates with me, particularly that you can't undergo that transition alone, that it happens in dialogue and partnership and conversation. But I hadn't thought to point that out. But, you know, it's interesting at the same time, and maybe there's a relationship here. You mentioned in your answer that it seems like during the pandemic, more people started becoming receptive to something different. And you say this in the book, and maybe it was in part because of the isolation of that pandemic and the need for connection. But in your book, you talk about how how humanity is already undergoing some sort of major transition. And I wanted to ask you about that because that's very much the point of this show, is to talk about how change is ongoing, radical change may be closer than we think. And so can you just maybe share a little bit more about what you see in the world around us that makes you feel like change is already underway?
Well, the quality of conversations that I'm able to have, the invitations to speak and do projects and offer consulting has really opened up. I'm able to go further with organizations. So I'm thinking of a biotech company, the leader of which reached out to me recently to say, "Read your book. I'm sold. We want to do stewardship. We want to be in the practice of stewardship, and we want to integrate that into our organization throughout." So do what you will with us. It's really, and this is the first time I'm experiencing that much openness, but it's indicative. It's sort of on the path that I've been experiencing over the last several years. I see in every sector of society, maybe not in the center, but at the edges, there's new conversation happening. And we've exchanged a bit about agriculture and tourism and education. There really isn't a sector, and just business in general. There isn't a sector that isn't exploring in some way what more is needed and what more is possible. What is the language that we need? What are the conversations we need to be having? So it's a really exciting time, as much as it's terrifying. Also, it's both.
It is. It is. Sometimes I find myself just so energized, ready to go, and other times I find myself so overwhelmed. Right. We share an interest in food and the regenerative food systems movement, and I think this is maybe a way that a point in our conversation today where we can get really concrete, because industrial thinking dominates food production right now. Everything is built around controlling life, rejecting life, rather than working with ecosystems. And that is, the way I understand it anyway, the fundamental reorientation of regenerative thinking is to work with the rest of natural systems. And so, you know, one way or another, we can't keep doing things the way we are with our food. I think everybody knows that. That's sort of what you were getting at. Everybody's coming around to the need for change. What do you see emerging in this area as you're working with people who are thinking about changing our food systems? What's exciting you?
So much. So much is exciting. So within agriculture, there is this shift from a story that says the farmer grows the food with their chemicals and their heavy equipment. It's the farmer that does the work. And it's a practice of physics and chemistry. Really doesn't recognize the biology that's involved. Okay, there's a plant, but you know, I'm doing the thing to make the plant grow. So within the regenerative agriculture movement, there's a recognition that it's the ecosystem, the living system that is the soil and the whole ecosystem that's involved, but really most of all, the living system that is the soil, not just dirt, but not just mineral dirt, but a whole living ecosystem. There is biology. That's what does the work. And that the farmer's role is to participate, to be a steward, creating the fertile conditions for life within the soil to do what it does, to work its magic. So it's exciting to be in conversation with farmers and bring the patterns of living systems that I bring to any context and help them see this is what's happening in your soil. I have no farming experience at all. So it's very humbling to show up and say, I don't know your business at all, but here are some universal design principles that I can share. And it turns out that they're really useful to help them understand their relationship with soil. And it's a shift in relationship and in role to one of stewardship. It's exciting also because as I learn with farmers, I'm able to bring that metaphor of soil to every context, to the biotech company, to education. Everywhere I go, I now bring the story of soil. Soil is an amazing teacher that's really accessible. And that means that as farmers struggle to make this transition and come to recognize that they can't do it alone, they need to be in conversation with others, partly because it's more complex. There's just a handful of methods of regenerative agriculture. Keep the soil covered, integrate animals, don't till. It ought to be simple, right? It's really pretty straightforward on paper, but of course it's not, because it's life and it's complex living systems. So they need each other to be in learning and in moral support. They need the whole system to change. It's really still not oriented to support this different way of doing things. So then you start to have a community, a human system together, and then it gets messy and difficult and confusing. And so we're able to bring the metaphor of soil into that part of the work, of the work of transitioning to regenerative agriculture. And we can have conversations about how do we cultivate the soil of community.
It's a great metaphor in a lot of contexts. And in your answer, you talked about bringing some universal design principles that it does get messy, right? Because these things are very place-based. Living systems are very unique and discrete, right? Esoteric in a way. But earlier, at the same time, you mentioned a number of different sectors where you're seeing interest. And you mentioned these universal design principles. So it has me wondering, how does that translate then, say, to another sector you work in? You've mentioned biotechnology. I also know, say, you work in tourism.
Tourism is another nice example, in part because we are all tourists. We're all hosts and guests, right, in different times in our lives. And we are all part of communities. So the tourism sector has been as mechanistic as every other sector for the last decades. And the goal has been just as many consumers as possible, you know, and as much money as possible. And it's really envisioned almost as a conveyor belt. Get people through volume and gross revenue are the real indicators of success. But the whole sector is running up against the limits of that story and the limits of community tolerance. So there's conversation about how tourism is losing its social license to operate. So communities are blocking tourism actively, and certainly growth of tourism in airports and Airbnb and things like that. So the pandemic was a useful pause. It was devastating, really, really difficult, but also created space for some pretty radical conversations that were just starting, but really during the last couple of years spread and deepened. So there's conversation about regenerative tourism. Now, I would say thrivable tourism, but for example, there are regional and national organizations dedicated to growing the tourism sector. And their mandate up until recently has been to manage the tourist destination. And it's really a sort of mechanistic thing and approach. And through these conversations over the past couple of years, we're shifting the conversation away from managing the tourist destination towards cultivating the hosting community. And that changes a lot.
Regenerative tourism. Now, I like that, but I know that some people will hear that and point to it to say that this word regenerative is coming to mean everything and hence nothing. What do you say to that?
We've latched onto this word regenerative that maybe we heard in relation to agriculture or somewhere else, and it seems like the right thing. When we recognize that fundamentally it's a synonym for healing, right? And that we're healing our relationship in agriculture, we talk about healing the soil, healing our relationship with soil as essential to healing ourselves, our communities, and our world. That's a big conversation in agriculture. So in tourism, when we recognize regeneration is really about healing, then we see that it's not the job of the tourist to do that, to heal us and our community. Because the first instinct was to say, okay, regenerative tourism must mean the tourist does something different. they have to be more responsible. They have to not use plastic straws. But we're bringing the conversation back into the community to say, what is the healing that's needed here? What's the healing that's possible only here because of the unique characteristics of this place? And therefore, what is the unique hospitality that can be offered? And hospitality comes from the same root as hospice and hospital. So it really is all rooted in healing. So there's just a much deeper and more ecosystemic conversation that's happening now. It's very exciting.
I love the parallels there because we're healing from a lot, right?
Right.
Including the pandemic. And I got thinking about ecosystems, and you mentioned the pandemic and noted it, the pause, the disruption, the opportunity or the space that created. And it makes me think of how similarly over long time scales in ecosystems, disruptions are critical. Fires, forest fires are critical to the long arc of that forest. And I'm curious what you think of, what advice do you give to people to take advantage of disruption or maybe to nudge it?
That is a great question. Part of the benefit of this living systems view of the world is that we can embrace disruption and even death and renewal. In a mechanistic worldview, endings are failures. A machine is never supposed to stop. So there's shame and blame involved in endings and disruptions. But in a living systems worldview, that's a valid question that you're asking. There are rhythms to life. There are moments of pause. So the first thing I would advise is recognizing that, taking the time to reflect on what is the value and the meaning and the use of this moment. What needs to die? What needs to be composted and brought back to life in new form?
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing.
Yeah. Another good metaphor, the composting.
Exactly.
Yeah. You know, Michelle, I ask everybody who comes on this podcast the same question. And I'm really curious to hear where you take your answer to this, because I know you do work in a variety, you work with people in a variety of different sectors. What is the most radical change you'd like to see unfold or finish unfolding, perhaps to go with where we started, in your lifetime?
Such a good question. Well, I'll tell you my dream. It feels radical. Maybe it's not all that radical, but we talked about how to make this shift from one worldview to the next, it requires some conversation. I also think it takes practice. You know, that informed intention and practice. And so we need practice grounds. We need something to work with. It's not enough just to be thinking these new enlightened thoughts. It's how we show up and put them into practice in the world. So my dream is that every organization, every business, every project comes to be seen as a practice ground for a more thrivable world, that we automatically come in knowing that's the real purpose of our work, and the details of whether it's farming or tourism or biotech or anything, that's sort of the excuse. But what we're really in it for is to become better ancestors, better earthlings, better humans together. And how exciting is that? And how curious can we come with this attitude of learning with that informed intention and practice? So that's my radical revision of the world.
Well, I do think that's radical, but it's also very reasonable, right? I mean, it makes sense. And that what it evokes for me is when you're practicing, you're not always getting it right. And so a space for practice also means a space for some failures.
Mm-hmm.
And that's scary to people right now, given the stakes of some of the challenges we're up against, right?
I think, again, it's back to that living systems worldview that life makes mistakes. Life tries different things. I'm always surprised at how much the mechanistic story has convinced us that we're not worthy of thriving. We're not allowed to feel joy and to play. It has convinced us that play is the opposite of work, when in fact It's the highest form of work. It's the way we collaborate and innovate best. So if we can set those beliefs aside, really embrace a culture of learning and curiosity, and that's really at the heart of this shift in agriculture in particular, to be open about the things that we're curious and learning about and experimenting with, then I think anything is possible. You're asking the right questions.
I appreciate that, Michelle. This has been a really fantastic conversation.
Wonderful. Thank you. I've enjoyed it too.
Thanks for listening. Today we heard from Michelle Holliday, author of The Age of Thrivability. You can find more about Michelle and her work in the episode notes. The Second Transition podcast is produced on the traditional lands and treaty territory of the Mississauga of the Credit, also known as Dish with One Spoon territory. The Second Transition podcast is supported in part by the Arrow Food Institute and in part by Voice Ed Radio. See you next time.